Yeah, Derek,
Yes, ma'am.
I think we can hardly hear you.
How's that?
Thought it was me.
Great.
Thank you. No wonder Chris didn't hear me. Hold on then. Hey, good evening, everyone. Nice to see you. Welcome to Tuesday night at the Moonshine Lounge. Any comments or questions or concerns from the past couple of weeks before we launch in? We ended on page 42. It's my recollection. No, 41.
It's 36 in the digital, what, non-tantric Mahamudra? Is that the beginning?
No, Moonbeams of Mahamudra.
Moonbeams.
I think.
No, well,
Did we go through that and stop it before part one?
we stopped at the beginning of part two in the book. We stopped at the end of part one.
What do you mean the end of part one?
It's in the book. The Roman numerals are XLIV. I don't know. The top of the page number is XLIV, and we stopped at the bottom of the page.
Excel Ivy. Excellent Ivy. That's a great motto. This is the Rinne Shaidra, the world of excellent Ivy. Anyway, why don't we start from XL one? You know, maybe the pagination is different in subsequent publications. I got the first printing of this monolith. The header is Moonbeams of Mahamudra. So we're in the translator's introduction. And it's right after Thakpo Tashi Nhomgyel Times, Life and Times. Sound good?
That's fine.
Thakpo Tashi Nhomgyel combined numerous sources and instructions on Mahamudra and Shamatha Vipassana to create this comprehensive guidebook to the cultivation of Mahamudra. Although it hasn't been possible to identify all the sources he used at the moment, it seems we can say that the following are relevant to the composition of moonbeams. Maybe not that fascinating to everybody here, but the author, the translator, tries to track down his sources, collected works of Kampopa. Texts included in this collection of his collected works are, for the most part, not authored by Kampopa, but records of his oral teachings written down by his students, and in some instances, students of subsequent generations, which happens often with great teachers in the Tibetan tradition in the past, as well as the Western world. The first xylograph printing was made in 1530-20 under the direction of Tashi Namgyal's uncle. It's all in the family. Sonam Lundrup, and includes his biography of Gampopa, the flag of renown, the Indian Mahamudra text compiled by the 7th Karmapa, Shudrak Jatso. And this collection contains the famous seven city texts, the 16 essence cycle and the 24 texts and the Dharma cycle of non-mentation. I think we did go through this, right? Okay, so let's skip.
No, we didn't, Derek. She
Oh,
just mentions that number a number of times in this introduction. She
she
goes through
does.
that list.
She
Yeah,
likes
so
that
we
list.
didn't.
Okay.
Okay, Could you please repeat the numeral at the top corner? Somebody who sees where we are in the most recent.
XLI.
XLI. Okay, so we're back at XLI. Okay.
Yeah, which I think is 41 in Roman world. Is that
Yes. Oh, thank you.
But in my copy of the book, it's 38 or in 39, XXXIX.
Thank you, Liz. Roman numerals, boy. It's confusing. The cyclone Amanasikara is non-attention, non-mentation by Maitripa. The collected works of Pakmadrupa and Jigten Sumgun, the heads of Drukpa and the Drikhung Kagyu. These may have been available to Thakpa Nagshe Nabgyal in the Drikhung Kagyu Treasury of Dharma collection compiled by the 16th Drikhung throne holder, Khunga Rinchen. The collected works of the Drukpa Kagyu masters Tsongkhapa Gyari, Gutsongpa, and Yong Gunpa. Gu Lotsawa's Mirror Illuminating Suchness, a commentary on the highest continuum. The highest continuum. That's the name of a text, by the way, not a thing. And it's, well, sort of a thing too. But it's a text by Maitreya. It's one of Maitreya's famous five texts, or the five dharmas of Maitreya. And it's the one that points out Buddha nature in great clarity and in great detail and in great length. And Tsongkhapa's great treatise on the stages of the path to awakening. Yeah, we didn't go through this. I wanted to talk about this. So Tsongkhapa, if in case you're not familiar with him, he's the progenitor of what's known today as the Gelugpa tradition. And his students. His main two students were the first, were subsequently in second generations, recognized as the first Dalai Lama and the first Panchen Lama. And the Panchen Lama served as the regents of the Dalai Lamas until some point in time. And Tsongkhapa's great treatise on the stages of the path of awakening is probably the largest lamrim or gradual stages of the path text in the Tibetan tradition, and by far the most famous, and just like this enormous resource, and it's available in English. It's really cool. It was translated probably 20 years ago now by a team. It's wonderful. Let's see, Moonbeams of Mahamudra is called a gomrim. Debbie.
Yeah, I'm sorry, this is pragmatic, logistical, but do you care if, because I actually pencil in where we stop and where we start in the margins of my book.
Good.
Do you care if we just accidentally skipped a section? Because I was
Oh.
wrong with what I said, and on if you didn't cover any of this on Sunday at that extra a week ago. We stopped right before Non-Tantric Mahamudra, who started it. We haven't discussed Non-Tantric Mahamudra, who started it. So sorry for the interruption, but it's back a couple pages from where you just picked up.
Yeah, she's right.
She is right. I don't
Oh,
think.
that's
And
why
you
I
had.
said page 36, because
Yeah, you
that's
had
what's
said
on
we could
page
skip
36 for
that
me.
or skim it. And your reminder, you said we could skim it, but then there's another section on.
Oh, towards the
No.
end, we can skim it. Yeah, thank you so much, Debbie. That's great. And I'll check with you at the beginning of each class now. Remember to bring your purple crayon.
Yeah, oh, well, you better keep the recording on till the end, though, because
I
you
know you're
may need
taking
it.
off.
In
Okay,
7 minutes.
leave your pencil behind. Who started it? Billy Joel, I think, started it, right? No? Okay.
Started the fire.
Gimpo. That's it. I knew he started something. Kampopa himself did not use the term Sutra Mahamudra or say that he taught Sutra Mahamudra, even though he is said to have taught a sutra or paramita based Mahamudra, in addition to Mahamudra as part of a Vajrayana path, as we've seen above, right, with that list of the three types of presentation of the paths a couple of pages ago. As we've seen above, regardless of whether the non-Vajrayana Mahamudra the Gompopa taught to certain students consists of a third path, neither sutra nor mantra, or a sutra Mahamudra, was Sakya Pandita right that it was not the Mahamudra taught by Naropa and Maitripa? Crucial questions. For answers, we can look briefly at what may have been part of the Mahamudra transmission that Gompopa relied upon. Besides the teachings he received from Kadam masters and Milarepa, the two sources, main sources for his version of Little Lineage, Gompopa is said to have named specific texts as relevant for his Mahamudra teachings. In replies to the exalted Pakmadrupa's questions, who was one of his main students and began the Drukpa Kagyu, when asked which Mahamudra texts conclusively explain Dharmata and mind itself. So Dharmata is the true nature of reality, the nature of phenomena, and mind itself, which is the true nature of mind. Gompopa says the texts that teach Mahamudra are the dohas, the three new cycles, and so forth. The dohas referred to are most likely sarahas dohas. So doharas, dohas are tantric poems, tantric poetry, called dohas, sometimes created extemporaneously. Though they could certainly include those by Tilopa and others. Tilopa is famous for his dohas as well as his, he has a doha cycle as well as his famous Ganges Mahamudra, the exposition of Mahamudra that he taught alongside the Ganges, the famous Ganges River in northwest India to Naropa. The three new cycles, new at that time, back in like 1100, are the seven city texts, the sixfold essence cycle, and the Dharma cycle, and the Manasikara, non-attention, the latter being a collection of texts by Maitripa. In that reply, Gompopa identifies one textual link between his Mahamudra teachings and the transmission of Mahamudra from Saraha, the grandfather of all Mahasiddhas. This sounds familiar, by the way. through Shawaripa, who is the next lineage holder, and not much is known about at all, but he's always listed there, Maitripa, Marpa, and Milarepa. By listing these texts, Gompopa is referring to that branch of his transmission that comes from Milarepa to him, and from through Milarepa from Saraha. Another link between Gompopa's Mahamudra teachings and Maitripa is the statement attributed to Gompopa in Gu Lhotsawa's Blue Annals, which is the most famous history of Buddhism in Tibet up until that time. Reportedly made to Pakmadrupa, that the basis for his Mahamudra was the highest continuum, which is an English translation of the text Uttara Tantra by Maitreya. Gu Lhotsawa also cites the text by Maitripa student Sahaja Vajra and another Jnanakirti as evidence that Mahamudra was taught within a sutra or paramita context in India. Klaus Dietermas, wonderful scholar on the Mahamudra Kagyu, Mahamudra tradition, who has done extensive research into this question of an Indian precedence for Sutra Mahamudra, concludes. And why an Indian precedence? The Tibetans are obsessed with trying to show that their Dharma comes from India, because if it doesn't come from India, then it's looked at very askance. Completely askance and not really trusted as reliable. And you have to have authentic, reliable Dharma transmission that goes back to India and therefore to the Buddha. So It could be shown that both Sahaja Vajra's Tattva Dasha Katika and Jnanakirti's Tattva Tara, Tattva Avatara, sorry, contain not specifically Tantric Mahamudra teachings, which are a synthesis of the Tantric element of directly realizing emptiness or reality in a non-analytical way, with general Mahayana or Paramita Yana. So a synthesis of Tantric elements of directly realizing emptiness, so non-analytical, direct, valid cognition of the nature of reality or dharmata or emptiness.
Eric,
yes, sir.
By non-analytical, they're talking about a non-conceptual experience.
That's correct. Yeah, and they're talking about the way to get to it here in this case, by non-analytic, such as being slapped on the face by your teacher's sandals.
It's almost like forget what I'm talking, what I'm saying. What you have to get the feeling.
Yeah, well, it's like being led up to the cliff by analytical activity, and then jumping off. And, okay. And yes, at that point, like starting to talk gibberish, another language, you know, so that the conceptual mind gets totally confused and loses track. Yeah, so various techniques for inducing that state common to the Tantric tradition. So the Tantric tradition has deity yoga practice. So union with the deity as the embodiment of the guru. So guru, basically guru yoga. And then the other path in Tantra is the inner yoga, starting with the mystic heat or tummo. And that produces the non-conceptual state, the non-analytical state, whereas the Paramita Yona is analytical, analyzing, is there an essence when things are compounded, made of parts, and you can't find any essential part to phenomena. There's no fundamental particle, and causation makes no sense because cause and result never meet. And if they don't meet, how can they ever get to be friends? Our study of the blah, blah, blah has shown that no tantric empowerment or such skillful means as a great bliss are required by this type of Mahamudra, which merely depends on the pith instructions of one's guru. So by the way, we're in the introduction. The introduction is a bit arcane, as I said at the beginning. The translator is going through a lot of technical stuff. And it's sort of like going through basic training. You know, when you join the army, you go through this really arduous part of life. And if you make it through, then we get to the main text, which is much more fun. But it's a way of testing our determination and interest, devoted interest in the topic. And you can relate to that in various ways. You can try to like keep track of who and what, who said what to who, when and why and where. Or you can just let it sort of flow over you. Sort of like the Sadhana Mahamudra in that way. Like when you first hear it and don't understand it, just like let it flow over you. Let's see, then our study of this text has shown that no tantric empowerment or such skillful means is great bliss. So, as I just mentioned, the two avenues of tantra are the practice of a deity in union with one's guru, that one practices union with through visualization and so forth, based on empowerment, or tummo practice, the inner yoga practices, which generate great bliss, either one of those cultivating and culminating in the non-analytical, non-conceptual mind that was just mentioned. So neither of those is required by this type of Mahamudra, which merely depends on the pith instructions of one's guru. By arguing that Mahamudra is just another name for Prajnaparamita, and this is not uncommon. In text by Padmasambhava himself, he says, Prajnaparamita, Mahamudra, Mahaati, all the same. And in fact, they say the three greats, Madhyamaka, Mahamudra, and Mahaati. Is this another name for Prajnaparamita and for what is intended by the word Mahayana in the Lanka Avatara Sutra, famous sutra that introduces concepts relevant to the Mahamudra path? Shnanakirti tried to link non-tantric Mahamudra meditation with the sutras, such as Lanka Avatara. Therefore, it should no longer be maintained that non-specifically tantric Mahamudra is a later Tibetan invention. I don't know about you guys, but that is such a relief. The label Sutra Mahamudra came into use only later in Tibet, however, even though it cannot be ruled out that the Mahamudra practice of the Kagyupas inherited Chan elements from early Sino-Tibetan traditions, God forbid. It should be noted that sutra-based Mahamudra teachings have Indian roots, which can be clearly identified. To sum up, the blending of the sutras with the tantras is something that definitely started in India and not Tibet. So who started the fire was the Indians. Although more study needs to be done of Gompopa's collected works, his life and times, and other transmissions of Mahamudra in India, Tibet is becoming clear that while he may have done some things differently than his teachers, Gompopa did not teach in an unprecedented way and did not teach Mahamudra that was different from that taught by Maitripa and his students. Gompopa therefore did not teach a Mahamudra that is, for the most part, a Chinese Dharma tradition, as stated by Sakya Pandita. So he can go. Thakpa Tashi Namgyel, his life and times, 1513 to 1587. I don't know what was going on in this part of the world then, but he composed and compiled his instructions for the cultivation of Mahamudra, Moonbeams of Mahamudra, in an ox year. All in one year, either 1565 or 1577. In other words, that happened every 12 years, a little over 400 years after Gompopa passed away. Tashi Namgyel lived during a period when, broadly speaking, the Kagyu, Nyingma, Sakya, and Gelug monasteries coexisted on more or less equal terms, with varying degrees of uneasiness, rivalry, political flare-ups, and wars between them, alongside dialogue, debate, and intellectual cross-fertilization. There had been and would be greater turmoil and changing fortunes for certain monasteries depending on who dominated the political sphere. But during Tashi Namgyel's lifetime, the Gelug school, founded by Tsongkhapa, did not yet control the religious political world of central Tibet, as it did later on through the fifth Dalai Lama. Its control of secular and religious affairs would not happen until the 1640s, when, aided by Mongolian troops, the fifth Dalai Lama was installed in both the spiritual and political ruler of Tibet. The period following that saw the suppression and, in some cases, conversions and destruction of non-Gelug monasteries in central Tibet. Overall, the 15th and 16th centuries were a time when the individual lineages were consolidating their teachings, setting them out in relation to each other, and situating them within their transmitted doctrine. Major commentarial literature was being written. Tomes were composed on philosophy, epistemology, Abhidharma, Vinaya, Tantra, history, stages of the path, and of course, stages of meditation. And this was because the couple of centuries before that were a period of great transformation, great establishment of the new traditions. And so after they were, of all, basically all four schools, well, the three newer schools, as well as the Nyingma, who Longchenpa lived in the 1300s, Longchenpa, the third Karmapa, Rangchen Dorje, Tsongkhapa, they all lived within the same 100 or 150 years, and the Sakya Pandita. And so there was a lot of beginnings then, and then after that there's a phase of consolidation and fleshing out. Although many conditions facilitated this, there were two important developments related to books. First, during the 14th and 15th centuries, the Tibetan translations of the sutras and tantras were organized into the collection called the Khanjur. So, in particular, a gentleman named Bhutun did an enormous project of collecting all the texts that had come from India and assembling them into categories and standardizing them, editing them, and massive project and coming up and then having them printed in these collections. The Khanjur, which was the word of the Buddha, attributed the words attributed to the Buddha, and then the Tibetan translations of the Indian commentarial literature into a collection called the Tengyur, the translated treatises of the Indian masters. So that was a huge accomplishment that happened in this period, and that made available in a way that hadn't been before the rich variety and expanse of the Indian Buddhist literature. The second development was the introduction of xylograph woodblock printing, which made it possible like to print copies of books instead of having just scribes handwrite books over and over again, which was not only incredibly laborious and slow and limited, but proliferated numerous mistakes, because nobody's perfect. Xylograph printing developed in China during the 7th century, made its way slowly across Central Asia, widely used in China by the 11th, but it was not until the early part of the 15th that it became more commonly adapted method in Tibet. This new technology enabled monasteries to print large collections of texts such as Khanjur and Tengyur and multi-volume collected works of individual authors and made them available in an unprecedented way. Prior to that, the only option was to copy books by hand. This at the same time the great scholars and lineage holders were writing to define, clarify, and elaborate their approaches to the view and the path. They had greater access to the works of previous masters of their own and other lineages, and this presumably enabled them to draw on the earlier texts with more ease and weave them into new compositions, as we'll see in looking at the possible sources for Tashi Namgyel's moonbeams. Tashi Namgyel was heir to Gampopa's teachings as the first recognized incarnation of Gampopa as his distant relative and as the 17th throne holder of his monastery, all three of those. He grew up and trained under the guidance of his uncle, Gampo Chöji Sonam Lundrup, the 16th throne holder of the Dokpo Monastery. His biography recounts Tashi Namgyel studied and read widely when he was young. His primary teachers were Karmic Trinley, the famous Kagyu Tulkum, Kenshin Shakya Zangpo of Dokpo Gampo Monastery, which was Gampopa's son's monastery, because the transmission went to his nephew, I think we saw, and his uncle, Sonam Lundrup. His uncle is cited as the main one who transmitted Mahamudra instructions to him, and it is under his tutelage that Tashi Namgyel came to realize the teachings of Gampopa. During his early 20s, Tashi Namgyel practiced meditation or retreat for about 6 years, which culminated in his realization of the nature of ordinary mind and the equal taste of all phenomena. That's not bad. 6 years. We could all do that, right? It's just 6 years. It's what the Buddha did, right? 6 years. From 29 to 35. We're a little bit late, some of us. Then, let's see. Culminating is realization of the nature of ordinary mind and the equal taste of all phenomena. Interesting terminology. After that, he said he had no attainment or loss, no fluctuations in his spiritual practice. During his retreat period, he also studied all the books contained in the monastery's library. All of them. Which included the collected works of Gampopa, Indian Mahamudra texts, and the Book of Kadam, a famous collection of Kadampa texts. From then on, he spent much of his life in retreat, interspersed with periods of teaching, creating the circumstance for others to practice Dharma. The Book of Kadam, by the way, has been translated and published in the Library of Tibetan Classics by Tupten Jinpa. These days, Thakpo Tashi Namgyel is best known for his Light Rays Trilogy. Here we enter the wonderful world of text titles in the Tibetan tradition. Light Rays Trilogy, Sun Rays, a commentary in the Heivajra Tantra, which is the most famous tantra in the Kagyu tradition. Jewel Light Rays, a commentary in Vajrayana. Oh, I see. That's why. Trolloc Rinpoche has a book on Vajrayana, I think, called something like that, Jewel Light Rays. And Moonbeams of Mahamudra. Two of his shorter works are also well known, clarifying the suchness of the innate state, which is an abbreviated version of Moonbeams, translated into English as clarifying the natural state, and clarifying the suchness of the great secret, an abbreviated version of the Jewel Light Rays. It's on the six dharmas of Gampopa, translated by Garma C.C. Chang, both of which have been translated in English. Because Tashi Namigal does not provide the element associated, with the year for his composition, shame on him. We can't tell what year it is. His writings cannot be precisely dated. We can only assign them to two or three possible dates in the 12-year Tibetan cycles. The Tibetans, and as many as often the Chinese did, they just like listed the animal or the astrological sign of the year, and they expected each other to be able to figure out what year it was from that. Even though, like, every 60 years, the same animal and element combination repeats. But
right, but if they had put the element, then you'd usually be able to figure it out because it's pretty
based
obvious.
On when the guy lived, yeah.
Yeah.
But if you don't know when the guy lived, then you're totally out. Anyway, therefore, chronology cannot be established. However, since it's only within the last 15 years that we've had access to a biography, Thakpa Tashi Namgyal, it's possible that more historical records will appear that will enable us to date and order his writings. Texts are still being discovered actively throughout the world, which is amazing in the world of Tibetan Himalayan Buddhism. The famous Dunhuang Caves, you probably have heard that name. Dunhuang Caves, just massive amount of text just piled up, like unbelievable. So it's taking years for scholars to go through them. In recent times, this Dagpa Tashi Namgyal, the author of Moonbeams, has been confused with a different one. Talk about Panchen Tashi Namgyal of Nalendra Monastery, since almost nothing has been written in English about this Tashi Namgyal's life, and his biography seems little known even among Tibetans. Translation of his biography follows the introduction. Moonbeams are the sources, and we got to the bottom of the list. Moonbeams of Mahamudra is called the Gomrim, stages of meditation text, literature, approach to meditation text, which makes it part of the larger genre of stages texts. The others being so there's three types of stages. There's the most commonly known as Lamrim, just general stages of the path, sort of Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and Tenrim, stages of the doctrine, the tenets of the various schools, and then the stages of meditation, Gomrim, those three. These works discuss a graduated series of topics that lead the practitioner towards the goal of awakening. In the case of this Gomrim, since Thakpa Tashi Namgyal's stated aim is to guide us towards realizing Mahamudra, the nature of mind. Interesting the way those are sort of the way she writes that those are the same thing. Mahamudra is the nature of mind. He begins by discussing why we should meditate on the nature of mind. This is followed by the presentation of the process of meditation, divided into two main sections, the common samadhis, meaning they're shared by other traditions of Buddhism, and the uncommon, unshared tradition of Mahamudra.
Hey, Derek.
Yes, ma'am.
So samadhi, should we take that to just mean meditation in this case?
That's right. Exalted meditation, superior meditation, samadhi. And we'll see there's a shamatha samadhi and a vipassana samadhi, as well as many other samadhis. In the Mahayana sutras, there's literally thousands of different samadhis are named of all different types.
Okay.
So it's a general term meaning a superior type of meditation practice. The common samadhis, part one, provides the basis for the following section, part two of uncommon samadhi. So the tendency is to skip it, but she's saying don't. The sutra-based shamatha vipassana presented in part one are not actual Mahamudra shamatha vipassana, but they serve as what might be called the preliminaries or general training for Mahamudra meditation. Many of the topics covered in part one, mindfulness, drenpa, and alertness, sheshin. And so these are the two main qualities of shamatha. And you'll see, I'm sure by this time you've read many different translations of those terms from different translators and different teachers who teach in English. And it's helpful to become knowledgeable about these two main factors of meditation and understand that they are referred to with different terms in English, and to be somewhat familiar with the Tibetan would be helpful, so that when you run into these terms in other contexts, you're like, oh, that's the same thing that Elizabeth is calling mindfulness and alertness. The first one is pretty generally, universally translated as mindfulness. The second one can range from awareness to alertness to wakefulness to vigilance to introspection. And that unpronounceable collection of letters after the English is pronounced she-shin. The identification of flaws in meditation, the obstacles and the antidotes, and the remedies for those flaws are found in part two. And the readers often referred back to part one. Overall, there's a fugue-like interplay between the two parts. Sort of musical composition, isn't that cool? It's like they play off each other in the various chapters. While it might be tempting to skip to the parts we find most inviting, the later sections presume familiarity with the other ones. So don't you dare. Part one has been divided into four chapters. Chapter one is on shamatha vipassana together. Chapter two, shamatha. Chapter three, vipassana. Chapter four, removing doubts about the aspects of those practices. It also has a comparison to other texts that present these practices. They all include extensive citations from texts found in the Khandjur and the Tenjur, Khandjur being the collection of the teachings attributed to the Buddha, called sutras and tantras, and to some extent Vinaya, the rules for monastics, and the Tenjur is the collection of translated teachings from Indian masters, from Nagarjuna to Maitripa. It seems that Tosha Namgyal turned not to the Khandjur and Tenjur for his citations, but to the works of previous Tibetan authors. The two likely sources of Kompopa's collected works, particularly his sun rays of scriptural citations, and his famous Ornament of Precious Liberation, which is the correct translation of the title of that text, that Herbert Gunther translates as the Jewel Ornament of Liberation. The jewel part goes with liberation. It's an ornament of jewel-like liberation or precious liberation. And Tsongkhapa's great treatise of the approximately 237 canonical citations, but who's counting? In part one, 110, I love this numerical analysis she does, are found in Tsongkhapa's great treatise. So by far the most quotes are from Tsongkhapa. So he's like this reference point for all the other traditions. Really amazing. And not in Gompopa's collected works. 41 are found in Gompopa's collected works and not in the great treatise. So unique quotes. 12 are found in both, and 70 not in either. So that's the famous four possible types of relationships studied in the tradition of valid cognition, that they're either identical, or they're exclusionary, or they're overlapping, or one is contained within the other. Let's see. While it's possible to talk about Tosha Namgyal drew directly from canonical literature or from authors other than Tsongkhapa, a close reading of the great treatise reveals similarities to part one of Moonbeam's that go beyond shared citations. They range from topics to outline headings, to whole sentences or paragraphs. There was no problem with...
He copied.
This was a common practice in the Tibetan tradition, just lifting entire sections and putting them in your text if they were good and they were relevant. And they didn't seem to have any shame or hesitation to do that without letting the reader know, amazingly enough. And Jamgu Khonchul does this extensively in his treasury of knowledge, including the text on Shamachan Vipassana that I've taught many times and we've looked at many times. That is incredibly similar to the presentation of Shamachan Vipassana by Tsongkhapa in what's called his middle-length treatise on the stages of the path, not the greater one. The middle-length one is much more practical, practice-oriented, whereas the large great treatise on the stages of the path is very intellectual, dense. Daniel.
Yeah, I have a question. In our handout over the weekend, you included excerpt from a book on Dzogchen. And my question is about combining Dzogchen and Mahamudra. Some teachers say it's best to become stable in one or the other before you mix the two, and others say mix the two whenever you want, and I'd like your thoughts on that.
I'll go with door number one.
Okay.
Become stable in one before you mix the two, but that doesn't mean you can't study the two. It's helpful to study all of both of them. But then in terms of your practice, focus on one first before you move on to the other and practice graduated fashion.
Yeah.
So some details of these similarities are found in the end notes. Another thread running through the moonbeams is that sporadically Toshinomu frames uncertainties we may have in the form of questions or addresses misunderstandings held by others. This is a very common practice in Buddhist texts, where they incorporate into their text objections or questions from other traditions, or like from sort of imaginary students, imaginary opponents from other traditions or imaginary students, and they will pose the question and then answer them, sometimes answer them without posing them. Some of the latter, the addresses, the misunderstandings held by others are identifiable as being positions held by Tsongkhapa. So he's constantly like addressing differences between the Kagyu tradition and the Gelugpa tradition and the Sakya tradition by addressing points specifically that Tsongkhapa has given opinions on, as well as Sakya Pandita. Held by Tsongkhapa and his followers, though Toshinomu always refers to Tsongkhapa as a certain person. He doesn't name him, strangely. Or a certain scholar. He quotes Sakya Pandita directly, but never identifies him by name, and then refutes him systematically. It's sort of like they didn't want to get in trouble with the authorities. Like, I wasn't talking about Tsongkhapa. I was just like, saying somebody.
The former guy.
Yeah, that other...
So it's kind of funny. It's funny how they both borrow extensively from him, from these others. So they're in one sense showing the commonality and similarities, and then they kind of do these little attacks and clarifications.
Yeah, differences. So they'll show the similarities, and they have no qualms about doing that, incorporating similar with where they are of one mind, they incorporate, and where they differ, they try to show that. And why? Let's see, all of this gives the impression that he is at times in dialogue with Tsongkhapa and Sakya Pandita, and also with us, his target audience. Chapter 1, Shamatha Vipassana opens with a brief discussion about how they contain all forms of samadhi, from those practiced in the Hinayana Mahanayasu, Secret Mantra, and Mahamudra. Then the question is asked, how is it that Shamatha and Vipassana are included in all the samadhis? The reply contains definitions of Shamatha and Vipassana that are used throughout the text. And he quotes lots of different definitions from different sources. Simply put, Shamatha is when the mind engages one-pointedly with its object of meditation, and Vipassana is when Prajna is aware of the nature of that object. I thought I might read that again. Shamatha is when the mind engages one-pointedly with its object of meditation, and vipassana is when prajna is aware of the nature of that object. Which object? The object of meditation. So if your object of meditation is a pebble, then vipassana would be analyzing with prajna the nature of the pebble, and so forth.
And at this point, is this analysis, or is it, again, non-conceptual?
It's analysis. And one of the questions for us is, since we know that there's this scheme in the Mahamudra tradition of and the common, so-called Kama tradition of different types of objects for shamatha, ranging from concrete objects such as pebbles and sticks and Buddha images to non-concrete objects such as visualized syllables and colors and forms and the breath. And then there's shamatha so-called without support. So if you're supposed to then analyze the object with prajna in your vipassana, how would you do that when there's no object, when it's unsupported shamatha that has no support? How would you analyze that? That's a good question.
I mean, in one sense, isn't when there's no support, in one sense, the mind itself is the object?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And Tsongkhapa goes on at length saying that this whole idea of shamatha without object or without support is meditation on the nature of the mind. Whereas in the other traditions, it's usually not clearly identified as such. Anyway, the chapter continues with a list of the causes for shamatha, which are related to location, state of mind, and conduct, and the cause of vipassana, which are related to the qualities necessary in genuine teachers and the need for study. It identifies the five obscurations and the five faults we experience in samadhi and their remedies, focusing particularly on the primary obscurations, dullness and agitation, the main enemies of meditation. Of the remedies, the most important mental skill to develop is that of mindfulness. While there are many uses and understandings of mindfulness, particularly recently, one of the most common definitions of Buddhist texts is the one Asanga provides. Asanga is said to be the second of the two great charioteers of the Dharma teachings of the Buddha in the Mahayana tradition, and lived in about 250 of the Common Era or so, whereas Nagarjuna is thought to have lived about 100 or 150 of the Common Era, so Sangha comes a couple of, 100 or 200 years later, and he meets up with Maitreya, the future Buddha, who teaches him and gives him the five texts of Maitreya, which include the teachings on the Buddha nature, and hence the development of what some traditions call the mind-only school, the Chittamatra. Some traditions call the Yogacara school, and the focus on the third turning of the wheel of the Dharma teachings, as opposed to Nagarjuna's focus on the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma of the Buddha. And just briefly, just in case, the first time the Buddha turned the wheel in the Mahayana tradition, it said that the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma of the Buddha is the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, where the Buddha taught the reality of suffering and nirvana and the path. And the teachings of the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma is where the Buddha spoke extensively about nothing, emptiness, the emptiness of all phenomena, the absence of intrinsic nature of all phenomena. And the third turning of the wheel of the Dharma is described as that set of teachings where the Buddha clearly explained in what way phenomena are empty, and the implication is that the emptiness understood or presented in the second turning was incomplete from the point of view of those who adhere to the third turning as being superior or incremental, while many people view the second turning as being the ultimate. Big argument, two or three. Anyway. Sangha presents the third turning. He was a guy that went with the third wave. And he has a famous text, Compendium of Abhidharma, which is the companion piece to his brother Vasubandhu's text on the treasury of Abhidharma, which encapsulate the so-called Hinayana or earlier traditions' teachings on Abhidharma. Mindfulness is not forgetting a familiar object. So it's not focusing on something you don't know, it's focusing on something that you know. And its function is to be undistracted. Undistracted. Hit the nail on the head. So our author said one-pointed is non-distracted. Mindfulness is paired with alertness, which is the quality of mind that recognizes dullness or agitation. So that second quality of shamatha notices when mindfulness is weak or failing. It's also said that when mindfulness is fully present, alertness is as well. It's automatically there when mindfulness is strong. In the section called the analysis of the order of shamatha and vipassana, Tashi Namgu refutes the idea that vipassana can only be undertaken when meditation practitioners have achieved suppleness in shamatha. So suppleness is the stage of complete facility or completion, perfection of a meditation practice of either shamatha or vipassana. So there's some traditions that say you can only practice vipassana if you've fully accomplished shamatha to the stage of suppleness. And others say, and Tashi Namgyal is of the point of view that you don't have to. In the way to unify shamatha and vipassana, he explains why shamatha is not only a non-conceptual meditation. So ordinarily people think that shamatha is only a non-conceptual meditation, that it has no conceptual activity, and vipassana is not only a conceptual meditation. So in 99.9% of all the Mahayana teachings and teachers and texts in the world of the Saha world that we live in, Vipassana is an analytical meditation. That 0.01% is, of course, Trungpa Rinpoche, who presented a non-analytical Vipassana meditation. So for him, it was non-conceptual. And for everybody else, it's a conceptual meditation, primarily, but not exclusively. So this categorization of shamatha as being non-conceptual and vipassana as being conceptual is not a universally true labeling. Chapter 2, shamatha presents four objects of meditation. Now, these are not the four foundations of mindfulness that the Buddha taught in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra in the early tradition of the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma. This is a different scheme. And it's a complicated scheme because they're not mutually exclusive objects. They overlap in a weird way. Universal objects of meditation, sort of as it sounds, it includes everything. Objects of meditation for your for purifying previous behavior, as opposed to purifying future behavior, I guess. Objects of meditation for expertise, and the objects of meditation for purifying mental afflictions. Sort of an odd assemblage of types of object, but when it's explained fully, it makes more sense. Which we'll get to. It discusses the initial objects of meditation, the role of mindfulness and alertness, the well-known nine stages for achieving mental stillness being a synonym for shamatha with suppleness, and how those are cultivated with the eight applications, another alternate translation of the antidotes, the eight antidotes. The six strengths, or sometimes known as the six powers of shamatha, and the four types of attention in shamatha. This is the traditional scheme Trungpa Rinpoche taught in 1979 seminary. It's in the Profound Treasury. Chapter 3, Vipassana, starts by providing various characterizations of the practice. These are followed by a discussion of the view or understanding we need for practicing Vipassana. Interestingly, we didn't need to have a view or understanding for practicing shamatha, apparently, but for Vipassana analysis into the true nature of reality, it's helpful to have an understanding that precedes the practice of it. Interestingly, that there's no truly existent self of persons or self-entity of phenomena. At least at that time, when he wrote it back in the 1500s, there was no truly existent self of person or phenomena. Possibly later, maybe in the future, this will come about. The chapter gives us the identifying, that's a joke, by the way, guides us in identifying the correct view and how to apply that during both meditative equipoise and post-meditative attainment. And these are technical terms that in the West, in particular, in the West, and in many traditions, become called meditation and post-meditation. And post-meditation means like after the session is over, when you go about the rest of your day. It's very different from what the technical use of the terms meditative equipoise and post-meditative attainment are traditionally used for. We'll see that. Chapter 4, Removing Doubts, begins with descriptions of analytical meditation and resting meditation. So, conceptual and non-conceptual meditation. So that's where he'll go through this nebulous topic of where commonly shamatha is considered resting and vipassana as analytical, but he's going to show us that it's not universally that way. And then he discusses their roles, those two activities of analysis and resting in shamatha and vipassana, and in the context of developing the view through the practice. Having possibly drawn from Tsongkhapa's great treatise during chapters 1 through 3, in this chapter, Toshin Namgyel sets out how the Thakpa Kagyu approach differs from that of Tsongkhapa's followers. In analyzing other systems, which is a section within Removing Doubts, he starts with brief dismissals of some views purportedly held by earlier later Tibetan scholars, and then turns to four assertions that Tsongkhapa lists and refutes in the Great Treatise, giving his own assessment of Tsongkhapa's refutations of those four assertions. Next, he gives a long rebuttal to what he says the position of Tsongkhapa and his followers, that once we have identified the view, we must then generate strong certainty about the emptiness, that is the emptiness of inherent nature, the emptiness of any reality. In a nutshell, Toshin Namgyel considers this approach flawed because it involves clinging to the absence of reality or emptiness, which Tsongkhapa would ardently deny. But Toshin Namgyel and many in the Kagyu tradition holds that the presentation of Tsongkhapa does have that tendency to lead to clinging to emptiness. Hotly debated topic, because that's one of the main things that one is not supposed to do in the Madhyamaka.
Sounds like they were getting too analytical.
According to Toshin Namgyel, that's right. Not according to Tsongkhapa. Can't be too analytical. He then disputes that shamatha is only non-conceptual, vipassana only conceptual. We saw that, does not accept that all forms of meditation on non-conceptuality stray into being the repudiated Heishuang style meditation. So this was Sakya Pandita's charge or complaint or accusation, was that any form of non-conceptual meditation was like the Chinese teacher Heishong, who was defeated at Samye by Kamala Shila. The chapter and part one close. struggles with establishing our own system. And this is presented in terms of what ordinary practitioners can do, not from the perspective of those who directly realize emptiness, something only possible for those dwelling on the bhumis. Tashi Namgyal says the most important thing is to discover the view of emptiness, regardless of how we do that, whether it be by using analytical meditation or through resting meditation, which Tsongkhapa, I think, would agree with. Discerning prajna must be employed to discover the view, yet in the end, that very prajna disappears, and mind rests without elaboration. And there is the crux of the biscuit, prajna disappearing or not. In the Gelugpa tradition, prajna never disappears. Part 2 on common mahamudras, the longer section of the book, has been divided into 11 chapters. Chapter 5, generating confidence. So here we go through all parts of the book in summary fashion. Focuses on developing confidence in the Dharma or topic of mahamudra. The Dharma or topic of mahamudra. And in the transmitters of that Dharma, it begins by discussing the term and its divisions, ground, path, fruit. And then it looks at how it's presented in both the sutras and tantras. In the section called The Way, the exposition of three and four mudras are taught. Tashi Namgyal addresses one of Sakya Pandita's critical remarks about the mahamudra topic on Bhoban and his followers. After The Way, the uncommon mahamudra is taught. Too bad she doesn't say what that is, but I guess we'll see it when we get there. So it's a little disappointing, but he again turns to rebutting any notion that meditation on abiding state mahamudra is similar to a Heishong style meditation, doing so in a thorough way. An abiding state mahamudra, interesting term there. A mahamudra that is a state that we can abide in, interesting. In the section called How, in brackets, Mahamudra, is the profound point of the sutras and tantras, the author presents different ways the path of Mahamudra is viewed. When the path is only divided into sutra and mantra, it's considered to be mantra. In the secret conduct collections, so the secret conduct collections is some rare text that doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. Three on a system of the philosophical prajnaparamita, secret mantra vajrayana and the yana of the unsurpassed essence, the path of mahamudra is the latter. So in this one text, secret conduct collection, it sets out this threefold system of the path, the philosophical paramita yana, the secret mantra vajrayana, which is deity yoga and inner yoga of Tummo and so forth, and then jnana of the unsurpassed essence is the mahamudra alone. He mentions Saraha's reference to a path of the essence as being a short path and outlines Gampopa's categorizations of three types of paths we saw last week, where the mahamudra path is the one that utilizes direct cognition, recognizes the bases, and is for those of sharpest abilities, which is everybody here, of course. And curiously, these days, very few teachers will teach the path of essence without one going through transmission and nundro, except in a sort of essential way, as we're doing. We see many Tibetan teachers come to the West and teach Mahamudra in this way. Way back, I remember Sitö Rinpoche teaching, coming to the U.S. and teaching on Mahamudra, weekend program in all the different cities, and going through Mahamudra, the key teaching of the Kagyu. And so it's just very common to present Mahamudra without having gone through transmission, empowerment, abhisheka, and any sort of nundro or deity practice.
I think somebody did that last weekend. Yeah. On Sunday, somebody did a lot of pointing out in those readings.
I can't imagine who. Let's see. The chapter closes with an account of how the Mahamudra instructions were transmitted in India through the actual lineage and in Tibet through the practice lineage. These terms, actual lineage, Trungpa Rinpoche designed a banner years ago. I had lots of different banners, and one of them was true lineage, which I think is her translation of actual lineage. It was a Dungyu, D-O-N, lineage. Dun in Tibetan means like nature of mind. We just saw Semdun. So has many different meanings. Anyway, chapter 6, preliminaries, looks at what we need as a basis. This is first considered from the perspective of the general approach to the path, which includes turning our mind from samsara, seeking liberation, and so on. Then Tashi Namigal talks about Kompopa's presentation of Mahamudra as a short path that does not incorporate elements of secret mantra practice. If that is the path we practice, he says, those of highest abilities who are of instantaneous types first investigate the view and then are given the esoteric instructions and the methods for resting evenly right within that view. This is similar to the guidance given these days. Now, these days were the 1500s. According to the four syllables of Mahamudra, which is a famous text that Marpa comes up with from a dream that he receives of, he has of Saraha giving him these four syllables, I believe. Those of lesser abilities who are gradual types are guided through shamatha, then gradually through vipassana. That's me, the lesser types. What about you? This is similar to the guidance given nowadays according to the instructions on co-emergence or co-innate union, is how this translator translates the term in Tibetan, Lenchi Kyepe Yeshe. After Gompopa, Toshi Namgyal says, teachers in the Kagyu traditions combine Mahamudra instructions with aspects of secret mantra, and if that is the path we follow, it's necessary to receive Abhisheka as part of our preliminaries. Probably following what had become common practice, the fourfold preliminary practices are presented as the contemplation of impermanence, taking refuge, arousing bodhicitta, offering mandalas, vajrasattva meditation, and guru yoga, the four nundra practices, as they're now called. Chapter 4 closes with advice applicable to all of our spiritual practices, training in the five qualities conducive to liberation, how to begin and end meditation sessions, and how to conduct ourselves between sessions. It offers a much repeated gem of advice. Keep meditation sessions short and repeat them often. Chapter 7, Mahamudra Approaches, is a short introduction to how the Mahamudra path is practiced by the instantaneous and the gradual types. After giving a brief historical overview of which teachers taught for which type, Toshin Namgyal addresses those who maintain that meditation on the true nature must be based only on the explanations found in the sutra-oriented texts, something asserted by those who are critics of the esoteric instructions of the Mahasiddhas. So the Mahasiddhas were a group of radical outcasts from the monastery systems who rebelled against the conventional world of the monasteries in ancient India in like about 5th century onward, between 5th and 11th centuries in India. And they give rise to the Mahamudra tradition as well as the Dzogchen tradition probably. Sorry, I lost my place. He concludes by describing the approach he takes in this text. This Tokpo practice lineage contains both instructional traditions. One is taught for the instantaneous type who first eliminate their misinterpretations concerning the ground and root, the ground of samsara, nirvana, and the root of the mind, and are then taught the techniques for resting in that ground. We're not talking about 6 feet under, we're talking about resting in the ground of reality, the foundation. The other is provided for the gradual type who first pursue mental stillness and then are led to vipassana gradually. Although these days most people, being of the type that has a very clear and active mind, would at this point be more appropriately guided according to the first approach. Back in the 1500s, here I will give the explanation according to the latter approach in consideration of what is better known at the moment. thankfully. He tailors his approach to me or us. Chapter 8, Shamatha, begins with topics already discussed in chapters 1 and 6 and continues with an explanation of the 7 points of posture, 7-point posture for meditation. So interesting, he doesn't do the posture in the early common shared tradition of Shamatha, but does it in the Tantric Mahamudra section. The objects of meditation used for the practice of Shamatha here are categorized under the headings, the objects of meditation involving characteristics and Shamatha without characteristics. Instead of those 4 types of objects, so the universal objects and purifying behavior and so forth, he uses this system of with and without characteristics. The first are further divided into those with supports and those without supports. So we'll see different terminology used for this, these categories of shamatha. Sometimes it's shamatha with support and shamatha without support. And then within support, it's concrete and non-concrete. Here we have the translation as with characteristics and without, and within characteristics, we have with support and without. The meaning is the same. Objects of meditation involving characteristics and supports include using ordinary or impure objects, such as a pebble, a twig, and the like, and a pure object, such as the image of the Buddha. Tashi Namgyal explains that either is suitable since both can help us develop mental stillness. Objects of meditation involving characteristics without supports are either the breath or not using any reference point at all. We're still in the world of with characteristics, but without supports is no reference point at all. In Shamatha without characteristics, Tashi Namgyal discusses the key techniques of tightening and relaxing and the roles of mindfulness and alertness, along with much practical advice. But he doesn't say much about the object because there is no object. So he distinguishes between Shamatha with shamatha involving characteristics that are without support and shamatha without characteristics. So a further gradation of the subtlety of shamatha, basically without object. The last sections of the chapter describe the way to achieve mental stillness through, again, the 9 stages in conjunction with the 6 strengths and the 4 types of attention. Tashi Namgyal explains that in this practice tradition, mental stillness is the foundation for Vipassana meditation. Therefore, simply being able to maintain stillness, either effortlessly or with just a small amount of effort, is sufficient for the purposes of this context. In other words, achieving shamatha suppleness is not a requirement for Vipassana. This is one of the big debates in the Mahayana tradition, is like, how much shamatha do you need in order to practice Vipassana? In the early tradition of known today as the Theravada tradition, there's many adherents say that you need either absorption stage of experience, which is the stage beyond shamatha, or you need the first approach to absorption meditation called access concentration in order to validly practice Vipassana. And then in the Tibetan Mahayana system, we see implications that one doesn't need to achieve that level of shamatha, but that one of the stages of the 9 stages of shamatha is sufficient for Vipassana. And here we have such a presentation where he says, simply being able to maintain stillness, when we get there, we can look at like what stage of the 9 might that be, either effortlessly or with just a small amount of effort is sufficient. Throughout the shamatha section, we're reminded to keep our sessions short, how to use the techniques to achieve mental stillness, identify its development. Yes, Sue?
We see this a lot, keep our sessions short. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's a different style of meditation than that taught by Trungpa Rinpoche. Trungpa Rinpoche taught a type of meditation that was geared towards having one process one's psychological baggage by having very long sessions that brought up a lot of material due to the boredom that one would encounter. So the mind became like a fish out of water and was just like flopping around. Particularly on the in-breath, you know, not having an object right away in the in-breath led to a lot of discursiveness and distraction. And so in some way, it's a very radical and advanced process or practice to churn up mental material, psychological material, and have it come to the surface and be processed by exposing it to our awareness. As one progresses in one's practice and understands the nature of Mahamudra, as it might be called, or the nature of Dharmata, the phenomena, or the nature of one's mind, one begins to appreciate that that experience happens only in very short periods of time, and then fades into discursiveness rather quickly. And so the idea was to have shorter sessions where one could more clearly and crisply identify correct meditation experience and taste it, and not stay there after it has deteriorated for a long period of time. And in doing so, as in Trungpa Rinpoche's version, we go through the six realms. We just like go through all sorts of different realms of existence. And after one spends years going through the realms in one's meditation, the idea is, okay, well, let's focus on the Dharma realm, which is not in the six realms, but is separate from that. And identify what's true meditation and try to experience that. And to do that, it's helpful to have short sessions because it doesn't last very long for most of us. And so that's interpreted variously. Sometimes it's said, well, that means like 15 or 20 minutes as opposed to like 45 minutes or an hour. Sometimes it's said that that means as long as it lasts. As long as you're able to maintain actual shamatha on an object, as long as you're able to actually genuinely be vividly present, vividly and still on your object. And when that fades, then you refresh. And so this idea of sessions being like periods of meditation in between getting up and walking around or doing other things, it's not really the same. You could be sitting at your cushion and within 30 minutes you could have 30 sessions, or you could have 10 sessions or 5 sessions. So the short sessions, it really varies. If you want to take it very literally, it means like a few minutes. And then when your meditation deteriorates, instead of like dwelling in that discursiveness, you refresh yourself. You stop meditating, stop trying, and look around, refresh yourself, and then go back into it. Or it could mean just having, a lot of people would sit for 30 to 45 minutes. So instead, it could mean like sitting for 15 minutes, take a break, and sit for another 15 minutes. Or some teachers, my current teacher, Alan Wallace, Lama Alan Wallace, favors this idea of 24 minutes. That was a common period of time in the Indian and Tibetan world, because whereas 1 hour has 60 minutes and there's 24 hours in a day, if you say so there's 24 hours, which is 24 60 minutes periods in the day, and therefore there's 60 24 minute periods in a day. And so they focus on 24 minutes as being like a proper period of time for a minimum session. So it's variable.
So when you're doing it, when you're doing this kind of practice where you're monitoring your session in that it's here, it's here, it's not here, there's a kind of a Vipassana like activity happening there.
Well, in the traditional version, that's called Shesha. That's the alertness. That's telling you whether you're still meditating or not, whether mindfulness is present or not.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's really good
preliminary practice for doing Vipassana.
It is to sort of know whether you're actually meditating or not.
And these days
we all have the meditation chronometer, and you just plug in that onto your finger, and it beeps when your shamatha disperses, right?
As you said, I think what it helps to get away from the idea of meditation is what happens when you're on the cushion, you know, which is, you know, because we have this concept, when I'm sitting down on my cushion, that's my meditation. And when I get up, that's the post-meditation. And that's the ordinary view of it when you start. But here, we're pretty much this shifts
that around. Yeah. And Trungpa Rinpoche presents that point of view. He's like, even though you have thoughts, whatever thought, you know, whatever happens on the cushion, that's meditation. And he clearly presents that. And that's a good point of view to take for a beginner and intermediate meditation practitioner, that whatever, you know, happens, even if you're lost in thought, that like almost the whole session and the gong rings and you're like, oh, we're here meditating, that all of that is meditation. And he quotes Padre Rinpoche, that whatever thoughts happen on the cushion, there are pure thoughts. So it's a matter of like stage of practice and type of practice. Chapter 9, Vipassana, states that the Mahamudra of Vipassana of the Kagyu follows the instructions of Saraha, Shawaripa, and Talopa, as well as such sutra-oriented texts as Ranakar Shanti's instructions on Prajnaparamita, which remains the only one of these texts that's mentioned in these lists that is not yet translated and available in English. Kamala Shila's three stages of meditation, Bhavana Kramana teaches instructions on Madhyamaka Upadesha. In brief, Mahamudra Vipassana is meditation on the essence of mind, the means by which the nature of percepts and perceivers. How many percepts and perceivers? The nature of percepts and perceivers is seen. So percepts are that which are observed by perceivers. Perceivers perceive percepts, and perceivers are minds. The mind is a perceiver, and whatever the mind perceives is a percept. And it's this clunky language that's like used in order to sort of focus on the framework that our entire experience of our world is a subject-object experience of moments of little slices of phenomena that we perceive or that are perceived. You know, there's no we, there's no self. So it's just perception. And there's no true phenomena, there's just that which is perceived.
Can you remind me who Kamala Shila is?
He's the guy that won the debate at Samye, Shantarakshita's main student, and he wrote the three stages of the meditation, the gradual meditation, the Bhavana Kramas. Lived in the 8th century. Eric.
Hello.
Hi.
It says here, meditating, no, I've lost my voice, meditating on the essence of mind. I feel like before we often talk about meditating on the nature of mind, and I always feel like I get caught in some kind of weird trap between nature and essence.
That's cool.
Is the nature of mind is just that it's empty and the essence is it's like, I'm not sure. I thought we were meditating on the nature of mind.
That's a great question. Yeah, that's very interesting. So a few pages back on the top in my version of 42 XL II.
Yeah.
Which was before the author went through the sections of the book. She says, since Thakpa Tashinamyo's stated aim is to guide us towards realizing Mahamudra, the nature of mind.
Right.
And now we're meditating on the essence of mind. That's great. And to some extent, they're identical. Right? And I don't know that she actually has that nuance here of like, well, was it we realized the nature of mind? Realizing the nature of mind. So what would the nature of mind be? Empty? And we, to understand the nature, realize the nature of mind, we meditate on its essence. And what is its essence? Is
the clear and aware?
Ability to know.
Yeah. It's
clear and aware, something like that. That's possible. That's vaguely possible that there is that nuance there. That's a good question. We'll have to look into that.
I was going to say, it seems like in this context, I was thinking they were using them synonymously, but in the Dzogchen context, often they use those terms to make that distinction between the emptiness is the first, and then clarity is the second, and then the triad of the third is the inseparability of the two, which is also the unstoppability of mind. So it's like, I don't know if they're making that kind of distinction here. That's more common to Dzogchen, though.
Yeah, that's questionable. I don't know. We can ask the translator that.
That's right.
Get back to you. But I had an interesting conversation with her one day that nature is emptiness and essence is the luminosity.
Which is what they didn't generally say in Dzogchen. In that triad.
In some places, essence is empty and nature is luminous.
Yeah, it could go either way, I guess, but...
Yeah. Well, she says in this tradition... Anyway, we're cutting sky flowers, right?
But when you say in this tradition, what does she say about that?
She said that the nature is empty,
mm-hmm.
and the essence is clarity.
I think Mingyur Rinpoche makes that distinction. He uses those words that way. Mm. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah. Okay.
I just accepted it. I didn't really question why one was the nature and the other was the essence. So.
Let's see, back to where we were. In brief, Mahamudra Vipassana's meditation on the essence of mind, whether that's the emptiness or the clarity, we have to find out. The means by which the nature of percepts and perceivers is seen, and direct perception is taken as the path. So it goes beyond the analytical path. Throughout this chapter, Thakpa Tashinamgyel situates this system within the larger context of the Mahayana by quoting from the affirmation text and from various sutras and dwanchas. Here, the Vipassana instructions are divided into two main sections, determining the essence of mind and its various appearances. Presumably that might be the nature of, the aspects of mind, the clarity, and eliminating misinterpretations about a root or basis. In the first section, mind, thoughts, and appearances are analyzed to determine their shape and color. This is very advanced. Here we analyze the color and the shape of our thoughts.
I actually have a question about that, and probably we should skip it. But
parachute.
Seems like sometimes there is a lot of actual shapes and movement, like that seems like it's not words. I don't know if that's what is being discussed.
Oh, we'll have to wait and find out. Yeah, that's a very interesting thing. So, shape and color abode and support, like where is your mind? Where are your thoughts? What color are they? What are their shape? Where are they? And then their identity. What is their identity? What is their what makes them what they are, and how do they manifest? This leads us to the recognition, that mind and its radiance lack any nature, but it does have radiance, apparently. Although thoughts are mental appearances, and all manifestations of mind are considered appearances, here thoughts and appearances that are examined separately in this scheme. Because really, thoughts include appearances and emotions and so forth. But here they're looked at separately. Appearances, i.e., what appear to the six modes of consciousness or the six types, are not broken down into increasingly smaller particles, as one might do if you were like a carpenter or a physicist or a vaibhashika, and then determined to lack any nature. Instead, it is the mind perceiving those appearances as analyzed, because once the nature of mind is determined, then the fetters of perceived objects are self-liberated. So we don't need to go through matter. We need to just focus on mind, because mind is really the root of samsara. He also makes a point here that sums up the view of the Dzogchen Kagyu approach to Mahamudra meditation. And mind is the root of samsara and nirvana. In some instructional traditions, the various ways to investigate the mind are only methods that lead to a non-conceptual mind with its clarity awareness. They do not examine and analyze mind right with its movements and appearances. These can be seen as somewhat rudimentary because their practice causes most types of mind to be comfortable meditating when the mind is still, but to be uncomfortable meditating with its movements and appearances. So this is a very abstruse statement, and I think the point is that a lot of meditation systems emphasize meditating and looking at the nature of the mind when it's without thoughts, and view thoughts as sort of something that gets in the way of that process. And here thoughts are viewed as not viewed as something that gets in the way, but actually something that or some things that help us understand the nature or the essence of mind, or both of them, both the nature and the essence of mind, let's say. But it's a sort of a very leading statement that we'll have to come to later to fully flesh out, but it has to do with how we view thoughts as either obstacles or actually aids.
Right, and that's why you're keeping the session short.
So that why?
Because at one point, when you're including the thoughts in the practice, at one point, though, they do carry one away.
Yes.
And so it's knowing when that happens, when it's like, okay, I've got them, I see them, they're sort of far away, but uh-oh, now I'm walking around in them.
Mm. And so then they become a problem.
Yeah. That's what you sort of become, that, you know, whatever it is you're thinking, where
right.
you're observing it.
Right. Big difference, world of difference. Thank you.
So if you can do it, if you keep the session short, you have the ability to be on that.
Yeah. Good point. Thank you. So we'll just finish up this section and then close. In eliminating misconceptions about a root or a basis, the origin, abiding, and departure of mind, thoughts, and appearances are analyzed. Where does the mind and thoughts, where do they come from? Where do they abide? And where do they go when they leave us? Let's see. To the recognition that thoughts and appearances are inseparable from the essence of mind. Here we have the term essence of mind. That they are not distinguishable from the essence of mind. They are mind essence. Then the stillness and movement of mind itself are examined so that we see that they are identical in essence and just discrete isolates or facets. Isolates is an odd logical term for one. The idea is that it's one thing, but it has different, as she writes, facets. Finally, we're led to conclude that everything that seems to arise is unborn, unarisen, i.e. Tashinamigal says, through such analysis, you will experience the abiding state of mind, which is beyond conception and description, in the end, even discernment, which is what does the analyzing in Vipassana, will be self-pacified, dissolving into itself. So even the analysis in analytical meditation, i.e. Vipassana, will dissolve into non-analytical Vipassana. Non-conceptual wisdom will dawn. Towards the end of the chapter, Tashinamigal discusses what we should expect of our Vipassana practice, which includes the following. What are the criteria for determining whether it has developed or not? Genuine Vipassana, which directly realizes the truth of Dharmata, does not arise before the level of greater freedom from elaborations. So this is a clunky way of saying, does not arise before the completion of the second of the four yogas of Mahamudra, which is freedom from elaborations. The first one is one-pointedness. The first stage of experience of the Mahamudra path is one-pointedness. The second stage of the Mahamudra path, she translates as freedom from elaborations. Sometimes it's called simplicity. And the third is one taste, and the fourth is non-meditation. So the author is saying, genuine Vipassana, that which directly realizes the truth of Dharmata, does not arise before the greater level of greater. So each of the four yogas is divided into a lesser, medium, and greater level of accomplishment of that stage of experience. So complete accomplishment of simplicity or freedom from elaborations. Here we are discussing only the Vipassana that occurs within the sphere of ordinary beings' minds. Therefore, in this context, what must be considered Vipassana is an awareness of the key point that our own mind and thoughts and appearances, which arise as its expressive power, as discussed above. In brief, all phenomena, what are perceived and are perceivers, are ultimately without arising, cessation, or abiding. It is also to discover from within experience and with certainty that all such phenomena lack any essence or nature. That paragraph, and basically that whole section of the text, is something that you can read like 100 million times and still not quite understand what they're talking about. He also distinguishes this Vipassana approach from that of the Sutra approach. The sequence of how the nature of objects and perceiving subjects are determined is different. In the Sutra context, it is taught that without first determining the nature of objects, that which are perceived, the nature of the mind, the perceiving subject, will not be determined. Here it is thought that approaching it that way makes determining the nature of the perceiving mind later on much harder, whereas determining the perceiving mind first makes it easier to determine perceived objects. It will be as if they are self-liberating. So what they're talking about here is that many traditions of Hinayana, Mahayana, Vipassana analyze the object of mind, form, feeling, mental activity, and dharmas, or thoughts. And the way that those interact, the way those exist. And in this tradition, as opposed to analyzing the object of mentation, of perception, we go right for the perceiver itself. We go right for the analysis of the mind. And once we understand the nature of the mind, then the nature of the objects of mind, the percepts, will automatically become clear. Whereas if you understand the nature of the percepts, it doesn't necessarily clarify the nature of mind, but it acts as a stepping stone towards understanding the nature of the mind. So you get a taste for the level of difficulty of this text. It's not an easy text. It's not a walk in the park, but it is a climb through rocky terrain that's well rewarded with beautiful views and wonderful mountain, clear mountain streams, and so on and so forth.
How many years will it take?
Yeah, well, we'll see. We're a little bit behind schedule, so it'll probably take 6 years instead of 5. Any other comments? Questions? Suggestions? It's a good way to go to sleep, right? Good way to help you go to sleep. Yes.
I have a comment. I recall one teacher saying that the sessions should be short because if they're long, you're probably trying to force them, and now you're conceptualizing what you think you should be doing.
Yeah, that's a good description. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Okay, let's close with a dedication of merit. By this merit may all attain omniscience, may defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness and death from the ocean of samsara. May I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory.